Off the Beaten Track on Park Radio. An in-depth look at what's going on in Banff National Park.
Welcome to Off the Beaten Track, a behind-the-scenes look into what's happening in Banff National Park and beyond. I'm your host, Michelle Maculo. This week, we'll speak with social scientist Dr. Kathy Reddy about using a custom online panel that uses visitor input to improve service and better meet visitor needs in the mountain national parks. And we'll also speak with Grant Statham, mountain risk specialist for Parks Canada, about why, even when there's next to no snow, we should start thinking about avalanche safety. Social science, what is it, and why does it matter? Dr. Kathy Reddy now joins us in the studio to tell us about Parks Listens, a web-based tool that uses visitor comments and social science to help park managers improve the visitor experience in Canada's mountain national parks. Kathy, it's so great to see you today.
Thanks, Michelle.
So let's talk a little bit about what you do and what social science is all about.
Great. I love the opportunity to talk about social science. We have lots happening. We're into our third year in the mountain parks, and ask away.
Okay. So really, what does social science mean?
Well, social science is in the Parks Canada context is the study primarily of our visitors, also residents. We're certainly hoping to look more and more at the resident populations as well. But it's who's visiting our parks? Where are they going? What are they doing? What is their experience? What are ways that we can improve that experience? And those are the kind of questions you can only get at through social science by actually going up and using different devices. We're going to talk a wee bit about the online panel and also a number of surveys and interviews that we do.
So I guess social science isn't new, but is it either the way we're using social science in the park that's new or the fact that we're actually using it and trying to get the input from visitors to help us either with management plans or help direct the kind of experiences we have to offer in the parks?
Well, it's a shift for sure, okay, because for many years, I mean, Parks Canada was quite heavy on the natural science side. But we're realizing that we need to see things from the visitor's perspective, not from our perspective, not from, you know, the manager's bottom line perspective. But what is it that the visitors are doing? What's their reaction to what we're providing? What do they think of our facilities? So this is one way at getting at their perspective as opposed to making decisions just on our perspectives. It has to do with investments in infrastructure. You know, where's the best place to improve washrooms, roads, different facilities that all the visitors need to use. It has to do with programming, you know, what are the better interpretive programs, you know, how do we reach the visitor and get them to connect with the national park. It also has to do with management planning and state of park reporting, because these are new. If you look at like when the new management plans come out, you'll see that there is a greater emphasis on visitor experience as opposed to the, you know, the reports that we've had in the past. So to get that information, to put it into the management plan, you clearly have to do some social science.
And that's a really great way of empowering people and visitors and really having them make connections to the park and having them involved, because this sounds to me like there's, through this involvement, there's maybe more of a sense of ownership for the people who come to use the park, and also maybe a bigger sense of, wow, you know, we matter and somehow we can make a difference to making these parks as great as we tell everybody that they are.
Well, people do make a difference. We are interested in learning about connection to place and how people connect with different parts of our parks. It could be through the history. It can be through the landscape. But it's one of those important pieces that we haven't really addressed in the past. And we're not the only park system that's looking at this now. The national park system in the United States is very much involved in trying to learn about connection to place as well. It's a really tough research question because it involves how people think. And so, you know, you need some good qualitative research to get at that, and it takes time. But while we're doing that, we're also getting a lot of information on demographics, on where people are going, what the levels of use are in different parts of the park. And we're getting a lot of advice from people on what we could do to improve some of the infrastructure, some of their experience. In some cases, it's as simple as, I want to learn more about the park, but you need to have your facilities open at certain times. You need to have bigger parking lots or something as simple. It's logistics of getting the information to people in a format that they can absorb it and can leave the park knowing a bit more about it. And this, again, sort of in the full circle business, gets back to connection.
And so it sounds like we're starting to use some online tools to make some of those connections, which I think are really important because technology is a good way for us to reach those who live outside of the park.
Well, and the online panel is, I'm glad you asked about that because it's one of the tools that we're using exclusively in the mountain parks just now. And we're holding it up as one of our successful ventures in social science. We recruit visitors at the gates, the entrance gates to all of the different mountain parks. So we'll do a recruit at the different gates, entrance gates. People voluntarily join the panel. We're up to almost 14,000 members on the panel. You sign on generally for 2 years. And part of that is because we want to ask visitors who are, not that they're new to the park, but we're finding that as people stay on the panel for an extended period of time, they become very knowledgeable panel members. And so it's almost, you're getting contrived answers, but not necessarily that sort of first blush response to some of the questions that we're asking. Now, the one thing about the recruitment process, we're getting visitors, but we're not getting residents. And that's something that we're trying to think, how can you expand this to include residents? Because they're a strong sector of park users. The surveys are all based on management needs and questions. So a manager will come forward and say, I think, for example, we have long lines at the east gates on long weekends. What do people think about that? You know, is this really frustrating for them? We need to somehow reinvest in that east gate so that we can start moving traffic through faster on these long weekends. So we do a panel and we ask people, have you been stuck at the East Gate? How long were you there? Tell us about your experience. And that way we can get their perspective on it as opposed to ours. I mean, from our point of view, it's tough on staff. We have long lines that go out into the provincial part of the highway, so there's a public safety issue. But let's hear what the visitor has to say. And that helped us to decide what we would do about reconfiguring the East Gate and trying to move people through faster. To our surprise, a lot of people didn't find that to be an incredibly frustrating experience, to be sitting at the East Gate for an extended period of time. In our view, this looked like a ghastly experience. So we were able to put in some new infrastructure that will sort of, it'll offset some of that wait time, but it wasn't necessarily as grand or as expensive as we might have developed on our own without that information from the visitors.
And I guess here's a good opportunity to mention that the program the online panel is aptly named Parks Listens.
Yes.
And I think that's really important because we're really learning what we need to do and maybe how we can do that. And it's a very simple tool that sounds highly effective.
Well, this is the best part of it. So you have 14,000 people on the panel. Now, to go out and actually interview 14,000 people with the staff that, I have my summer staff every year, well, we just would never get around to doing it. And yet the panel, you send the survey out. People can fill it in at any time because it's online. I mean, if you're a night owl and you want to fill it in at 4 a.m, you can do that. So it's convenient for the people who are responding to the surveys. We get a very, very quick turnaround. And so the survey goes out. It's usually out online for probably 2 weeks. We're finding 2 weeks is about the best length of time. You get an initial response where you get probably 80% of the people who are going to respond do so in the first 2 or 3 days. You do a bit of a reminder after the 7th day. You get a few more people. And then after 2 weeks, if you've pretty much got the bulk of the people who are interested in replying to the survey. Within another 2 weeks, we've got a report. The analysis is done by Ipsos Reid. We have a draft report in our hand. So that manager who asked the question, in the middle of February, has got a report in his hand no later than the end of March. So that's an incredibly quick turnaround. It's inexpensive. It's costing us approximately $12,000 for each survey that we send out. And to reach that many people and to get your report back in that quick a time, it's very cost effective as well.
And what's the most surprising thing you've learned since this online panel's been in existence?
I was surprised at the growth of the panel, the fact that we can maintain 14,000 people And that some of them don't want to leave after 2 years. And part of it, I think, is we purposely picked, when we started the panel, picked topics that we thought people would want to comment on. And I mean, we all know that grizzly bears, everybody loves to talk about grizzly bears. And so we had a couple of surveys that looked at, you know, those sort of charismatic topics. Now, not all of the topics, I don't think, have been that charismatic. But at the same time, I think people are learning a bit about Parks Canada while they're filling out the survey, which goes back to my earlier comment about after 2 years, we now have a knowledgeable base. And so, you know, maybe we need to rein that back a bit.
So what's next for the panel?
Well, we've got a number of surveys in the queue that will get us through to the end of March. And right now we're hoping to secure funding for the next couple of years. We'd love to get funding that would carry us on for perhaps another 3 or 4 years, but that isn't in the works just yet. So I think I wouldn't want to predict anything past the end of March at this stage.
This is fantastic news, Kathy. I'm really glad you came down here, and maybe we'll have you back a little later on to talk about some other social science, because it's great now that social science is getting a profile, and it's really exciting, I think.
Oh, well, thank you. I'd love to come back. I have lots more to tell you.
After the break, Grant Statham talks to us about avalanche danger in the shoulder season.
Off the Beaten Track, we'll be right back. And now back to Off the Beaten Track.
Welcome back to Off the Beaten Track. October and November are considered the shoulder months in the mountain parks. This is the time of year when hiking is winding down, cyclists are getting in their last rides, and the ice is beginning to form. And while typically there's not much snow during these months, outdoor enthusiasts need to start thinking about avalanche safety now. I'm happy to have Grant Statham in the studio to talk to us about shoulder season opportunities while keeping avalanche safety precautions in mind. Grant, thanks for coming down and joining us today.
You're welcome.
So, it's sort of the shoulder season right now. We've got people still trying to bike. We've got people still hoping to get a little bit of hiking in. But now is the time when winter's at the doorstep. So, what should we be thinking of in terms of snow safety, even though we're not very far into the season?
Well, it depends where we're going to go and what we're doing, but if we're going to be going up to any of the higher elevations right about now, we need to be thinking about snowpack, you know, if there's enough up there and if there is, where it is.
So does that mean we should be start gearing up for preparation for avalanche season?
Absolutely. If you're someone who likes to ice climb or ski tour, or you're thinking about, you know, like I said, getting to a higher elevation, then for sure you should be thinking about avalanches. You know, it's not uncommon for avalanche accidents to happen early in the year, sometime through November or early December, and people are just kind of getting their head into it. So, if you're going to start going up high soon, then you should definitely be thinking about it.
So what is it about getting our heads in the right space? I guess what I'm trying to get at is that it's probably not wise to wait until January to realize that, you know, avalanches are, they're real in the Rockies.
Yeah, you can't wait till midwinter to figure it out. I think, you know, sometimes people just haven't switched gears yet because maybe they wait till Christmas or they're going to start skiing in December. But, you know, so much of it happens earlier, and you just need to get your head into the game fast and make the switch, because you can be walking along on grass. You've been, you know, doing summer activities for 6 months, and all of a sudden, bang, you step on a wind slab. And those things are hard enough to detect when your head is in the game. So if you're not really thinking about it or you're not prepared, it's quite easy to walk onto somewhere and realize, but you want to make sure you figure that out before you're standing there.
So can you talk to us a little bit about these wind slabs and how they form and why it's important to start thinking about the snow, even though there might not be a lot of snow right now?
Well, wind slabs are formed from wind that picks up loose snow and then redistributes it and blows it into a particular spot where it's locally deep. And it's not uncommon for wind to, you know, you can have 10 centimeters of snow on the ground and you can have a 60 centimeter wind slab around the corner. And that's common. That happens a lot. So early in the season, you know, people are trying to ice climb or they're doing some hiking or maybe even some scruffy ski touring. And there isn't much snow around, so they're not really too worried about avalanches, but all you do is come around the corner and all of a sudden you can be standing in a wind-drifted patch of snow. So you've got to really watch for that stuff. You've got to pay attention to wind patterns and how the snow is being redistributed through the mountains.
So obviously, we want to promote enjoyment and we want to promote safety. So you were talking about some of the things to look for. Are there sometimes things that are out there or factors that are in play that we can't see? So how are people, if they can't see something, either what are some good ways to approach traveling in avalanche terrain at this time of the year?
Well, it is. You're right. It is quite common that you can't. A lot of times, you can't tell what's going on up high, and information is often scarce in the shoulder season. Avalanche bulletins may just have been started. There's mountain conditions reports from the ACMG that don't have lots of information because there really isn't that many people in the mountains right now. So you really have to speculate and guess. And you know, oftentimes you might be, if you're an ice climber, for example, you could be in a gully at a lower elevation while meanwhile, you know, a couple thousand feet above you is where the snowpack is forming and it can avalanche down and hit you. And that's not uncommon early in the season. I'd say that situation happens every year. So you just have to try to get a sense of how much snow there is up high and realize that the difference in elevation really matters. And so if there's only 10 centimeters of snow where you are, if you know, the avalanche terrain extends above you for a couple thousand feet, then you should try and figure out how much is up there and try and guess or estimate how far that thing could avalanche if it came.
Typically, I don't know if there's an actual date, but in terms of fatalities or avalanches, when do we start to see that kind of activity?
Well, statistically, we tend to see almost one accident or one fatality a year. Not quite, but I would say it's very common that something happens before December 15th. And I'd say any time after, you know, well, if you're an ice climber, it can even be in October, but certainly in November. You know, lots of people, especially around the Banff area and further east, are ice climbing like crazy. It's a, you know, it's a great time of year to be ice climbing. You just got to really watch it because, you know, there's avalanche danger going on up there. So, yeah, I'd say after November 1st, I definitely have my brain switched into avalanche mode.
And what are some ways that people can sort of prepare and get tuned up to have a really fun, long season?
Well, if it's not something you do all the time, then, you know, you should take a bit of time every year. I think it's worth reviewing a book, you know, pick up an avalanche safety book. You can get some good ones, some thin ones, and review it, you know, reread the chapters on terrain evaluation and wind loading and just get your head into the game a little bit. You know, pull out your equipment, make sure you have fresh batteries in your avalanche transceiver, check out your gear. You know, practice with your friends if you get a chance, too. You can run around with the transceiver and have some fun times trying to see who's fastest or... You know, the best thing, I think, one of the really good things is to do some real rescue simulations with your friends as well. And again, make them fun. You know, it doesn't have to be too heavy and serious. Have some laughs and get, you know, three or four people together and bury some stuff and just play the game. And all that stuff adds up, you know. So if you just take an afternoon and do that, that'll get your head in the game fast.
In the event that there's not enough snow, is there the option of having these practice sessions either in a field or somewhere? What are some options for people at this time of the year?
Well, you don't necessarily have to go out in the mountains to practice all this stuff. You know, you can do it in your backyard or you can go to a field in town or, you know, even to a trailhead with an open space. And you want to find a bit of snow in the ground. I mean, that it works without snow, but if you can find a place with a bit of a snowpack where you can bury some stuff and do a few rescue practices, then, you know, that'll work fine.
So you mentioned earlier that this time of the year can actually be quite good for ice climbing and why is that? And if people are trying to get out there, I guess, where can they go or what sort of options do they have?
Well, early season ice climbing can be really great. You know, sometimes it's almost a secret season for some. We used to try to not tell too many people because it was not that busy, you know, and there'd be great climbing through November. Depends on the year. If there's tons of snow, then obviously that's not true and maybe it's a better time to think about skiing. But you know how many years we get around here where it's not snowy in November, people are ice skating. That's usually a good time to be ice climbing. One of the reasons is because there isn't much snow around, so you can access places that you might not go otherwise. A lot of great ice climbs obviously form in gullies and in pretty serious avalanche terrain. And, you know, there's no way you would touch that stuff in January or February. But when there's no snowpack on there, it's a great time to go there. And a lot of them are not hard climbs. They're just in really big places. You know, you can read about those in the guidebooks. You know, there's some blogs online. You can follow that stuff. The ACMG Mountain Conditions Report is worth following. Will Gadd has a website that generally has great beta on it, and you can keep track of stuff on there, and people, you know, he keeps it updated with what's in and what's not. So, you know, early season can be great. It's really nice not having to deal with snow. to ice climbing. You can actually, you got to make sure you take a little bit of rock climbing gear with you for anchors and so on. But it's really neat to be way up on a big face, clung to a ribbon of ice, but there's no snow around. And you're not really worrying too much about avalanches if you're in the right place. And it's very different than the rest of the season.
And how about 93 North? When do things start to firm up in that neck of the woods?
Ice climbing on 93 North is awesome. I mean, that's a famous corridor for ice climbing. And again, stuff will start to freeze in November. It's, you know, it's very common to climb stuff up there in November, but there's more snow up there than in the eastern side of the park. So you got to watch for the avalanche danger a little bit early. You know, if you get up on some of those routes like Polar Circus or such, you got to watch out because the snowpack forms a little bit deeper up there. The Weeping Wall, that's a great place to go. Again, some of these have a little bit more volume to them. They don't freeze up as early, but you can get onto the Weeping Wall in November. And that's a place where generally we don't have to worry about avalanches as well, which is kind of nice.
And how about some skiing opportunities early in the season? I guess what I'm looking for is somewhere where people can go where maybe they're not wrecking their gear, because there is a potential that you maybe want to think about your rock skis.
Definitely, yeah, especially if we're in the Rockies. I mean, you know, it's pretty common to tell people, let's just drive west a little bit and go to Rogers Pass and Glacier Park this time of year, because they get more snow there. You know, get three times the snow volume in Glacier Park. So you get a deeper snowpack, and the early season is easier there. Around here in the Rockies, it all depends. You know, I'd say 1 or 2 years out of every 10, we have one of these seasons where we get tons of snow. And that's actually kind of from a skier's perspective, obviously, and an avalanche perspective. That's what we want. You know, I'd love it if it just started puking snow on October 15th and didn't stop for 6 weeks and we had one massive layer. I mean, that'd be great. And it would be stable generally. And, you know, we'd be able to go all over the place. But that isn't the case. So, you know, a lot of times we're scratching around looking for places to go, trying to cross, you know, unfrozen creeks and deal with bushes. And, you know, Rocky Mountain ski touring early season is pretty tricky, but there is places you can go. Again, near the Continental Divide, if you can get yourself up near, say, Sunshine Village, more snowpack up there, Bow Summit area, even Parker Ridge. You know, we want to make sure there's enough snow on the ground to cover up the vegetation because you don't want to wreck that stuff. But that's the place to go early for skiing, is try and get yourself up on the Continental Divide, or the further west you can go, the better generally.
Grant, I'm going to leave you with the last word. So given that it's early season, what's the message you want to send everybody who wants to go out and play outside?
Just switch your head on early to avalanche mode. Look for, look for good information. Avalanche bulletins from Parks Canada and from the Canadian Avalanche Centre generally start rolling out in November, usually November 1st at some kind of interval. Keep your eyes peeled for all the early season avalanche workshops that are occurring. There's some in Calgary and in the local communities in the parks. They're always worth attending. They're often free or cheap. And also we've got brochures out there on avalanche terrain for ice climbers and for skiers. And it just tries to give people ideas on where's appropriate choices given the conditions. So, you know, look for all that information, go through your gear, and, you know, most of all, get out there because it's just a great time of year and there isn't that many people out there yet. So, you know, when the weather's good, I'd take advantage of it.
And can you leave us with a couple of those website addresses?
Yeah, well, the best one to get to the avalanche bulletins is www.avalanche.ca. And that's probably the one address I'll leave you with here. If you're interested in Parks Canada information, go to that website and you'll see a button for Parks Canada right there. Hit that button and you'll come into all our avalanche bulletins, all our terrain information. And yeah, so avalanche.ca is your portal for avalanche information.
Grant, it's been great to have you. And I'm going to pick your brain a little on later on in the season, if that's okay.
Sounds great. Thanks a lot.
If you have any comments on what you've heard on the show this week, give our feedback line a call at 403-762-1536 or send us an email to feedback@parkradio.ca and we'll play your comments on a future show. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Michelle Maculo. We'll catch you next time, Off the Beaten Track.
Off the Beaten Track, only on Park Radio 101.1 FM.